Hi everybody, this is Chris Deasy and my guest this week is Stephen Garner, who works at Laidlaw College in New Zealand. It was 9 o'clock in the morning, 9 o'clock at night when I met up with Stephen, and I think it's a pretty good quality call. And we talk about how he is academic dean at Laidlaw and senior lecturer in theology. We talk about how the seasons are different between our two countries and how Christmas and its attendant nostalgia fits into this framework. We also learn about the time he once celebrated his birthday twice in 1 year. Stephen works in the areas of technology and new media and bioethics and transhumanism, as well as religion and popular culture. And that's how I know Stephen. He tells us about his interest in collecting film resources, for example, by rummaging through secondhand stores. He's interested in materials from the Pacific, foundational to New Zealand cinema, which are increasingly unavailable. So he is accumulating physical media that is disappearing and has up to 1,500 DVDs. We discuss the differences in curating our own movie collection when we are dealing with physical products and how it can't happen in the same way in a streaming context. The packaging also tells a story of a particular time. Stephen also reflects on the importance of having personal contact with a vendor and the serendipitous encounters he has had with physical copies. We learn that Stephen was born in the UK and moved to New Zealand in the 1970s. He shares his earliest memories and talks about how he has returned in later years to some of the places in the UK where he grew up. He was the only kid in his school who had a library card, and we discover how books and comics allowed him to explore his innate curiosity. We find out how Stephen ended up doing theology and how difficult it is not to offend somebody when sacred religious texts and popular culture are brought together, as with the Warrior Nun comic books, which we learn have some deep theology going on in them. We discuss satire and the concept of the Jesus that laughs, and we find out why Stephen gets his students to curate photos and how he learns from his students. Stephen is a systems person and was initially going to study astronomy, but ended up working in computer science. We learn how he made the move to the study of religion and theology, and how his PhD drew together computer science and theology. He is interested in stories of technological salvation, has always had a love for the craft of teaching, and we learn why academia is his tribe and why he never becomes bored. Then towards the end of the interview, we discover that going to university was a form of rebirth for Stephen, and we learn how memories that weren't positive have shaped who he is and how he uses his blog to reflect on himself. Then at the very end, Stephen talks about how he is exploring the notion of Christian hope as a way of linking together different things about digital culture. What an immense privilege to catch up via Zoom with Stephen Garner from New Zealand for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is such a pleasure to meet Stephen Garner, who is in New Zealand. It's 9 o'clock in the morning UK time, so it's what, 9 o'clock in the evening on the same day. Is that right, Stephen?
Yeah, that's right. And we're moving into summer now, so the evenings are getting a bit longer and we're on summertime. So
I'm very jealous because we have the opposite problem, because our university term hasn't long started. And of course, because of all the social distancing going on, we're not seeing our students face to face as much as we'd like. And of course, also the evenings are drawing in. So you have that sense of hibernation. You know, nature's telling us to hibernate, but life is also getting busier and busier. So I'm most envious of what things are like in the southern hemisphere.
Yeah, well, we get the reverse moving into Easter. So the closer we get to Easter, the darker it gets here. So the Good Friday experience seems to be in some ways more real than the Easter Sunday experience of resurrection and spring and new birth, because we're moving into the winter. So it gives a different sort of flavour perhaps to Easter and Christmas in those kinds of ways.
Yeah, and I also think that there was always a debate in this country, in the UK. Robin Cook, now sadly passed away, who was Foreign Secretary at one point, had a real thing about people who used to go away to sunnier climes at Christmas. He'd say that, there's something very special about Christmas. When you'd meet strangers, you do sorts of things that you wouldn't do the rest of the year. So why would you want to escape that? You should indulge in that and, make the most of it, because it's very transitory. And there is something about the seasons, because I studied Christmas a few years ago for my research, and yet I also feel very ambivalent about that time of year. I think I'm maybe it's because I'm born in June, but I'm definitely more of a summer person. So, but for you, it's on its head. You have a relatively warm Christmas and a cold Easter.
So our long school holidays, long university breaks, long work breaks are over that Christmas New Year period. So normally about the week before Christmas, people are thinking about packing up and heading to the beach or heading away to families, with their tents and things like that. And Christmas is, the barbecue and what's going on around that, or swimming, or surfing, or do, going out into walking in the forests or something like that. So quite a different experience, and also a rebranding of the symbols of Christmas too. So, yes, we still have sort of the semi-commercialized fir trees and things like that as well, but we have a particular New Zealand native tree, the pohutukawa, that blossoms just around Christmas time. Big red flowers. And so, that is sort of our own unique Christmas tree. And so, maybe some of the sort of nostalgic or looking back, to Christmases and summers as children, there's this Christmas, New Year, everybody's in their summer holiday mode, and quite a different sort of laid back experience. And nobody really feels like going back to school or work or anything like that, probably to the end of January. So, it's and then of course, our hottest months are February and through into March. So, the temperatures ramp up just as people head back to school and things like that. So, that's when there's athletics and school swimming sports and all those sorts of things are around that time.
And we first met, I think, well, maybe even the only time we met was in Canterbury, wasn't it? It would have been in the cathedral at a conference in 2014. That would have been right in the middle of summer, maybe sort of first week of August. So I'm guessing in that sense you had a double summer that year, because you came to Britain at just the right time in terms of beautiful weather, which we most certainly had. I remember beautiful backdrop of the
That
cathedral.
too. And even one year, I flew to the UK around my birthday time. So I actually had two birthdays one year because I crossed the date line, left on my birthday having celebrated, and arrived to celebrate my birthday a second time in the same calendar year, which is a novel sort of experience.
Well, it sounds like something out of a Christopher Nolan movie. There we are. You get to live your present, your past, your future simultaneously. But do you want to say a little bit, Stephen, about what you do, what you work on, and where you work?
Okay, so currently I'm based at Laidlaw College here in New Zealand. We're what's called a private training establishment. So we're a higher educational tertiary education college, and we deliver a range of programs. We from certificate right the way through to being accredited to deliver some doctoral degrees through the Australian College of Theology. We do teacher education, so the degrees that people need in order to go into primary teaching and into secondary teaching. We do counsel degree training for counselling, and then we do a range of theology programs as well, sort of from certificate right the way through to those masters and doctoral kind of things. And in this, I've been here at Laidlaw since the beginning of 2014, and on my current role, I'm the academic dean. So a lot of my time is looking after the academic quality that's going on and writing policy and stuff like that, which I actually quite enjoy, but also senior lecturer in theology as well. And so my background is both in computer science and theology. And so my sort of two main research projects is one is on the area of theology and technology, and particularly in the area of new media and internet, but also in the area of bioethics and transhumanism. And then I have a second project, which is religion and popular culture. Again, which it particularly picks up on some of the things around science fiction, comics in particular, Jesus films, and things like that. And then along the way, I also teach, you know, ethics and public and contextual theology and, you know, a variety of other sorts of things along the way. So that's sort of what I do. And yeah, it's been a bit of a journey to get to this point.
Well, absolutely. We'll talk about that journey in just a second. But I'm always very impressed. I see sometimes your the comic books or the videos. I think you have a passion, don't you, for finding old VHS versions of films that are no longer easily accessible.
Yeah, I mean, there's one of the things I've discovered is that everyone talks about digital media, everyone talks about streaming, but actually that's fairly ephemeral. So something you purchased or thought you purchased, say on a music store or a video store or something like that, you purchase the license for that, and the company that's licensing it to you may not have licensed it in perpetuity. So things disappear from catalogs, and the same and places like, you know, other streaming services rotate what they've got as well. And then in different parts of the world too, you don't get everything that other parts of the world get. So often what we've got is we have geo-locking, which prevents us from seeing a whole lot of stuff in the northern hemisphere that we can't actually access. We'd like to pay for it, but we can't. So you end up having to buy physical media from overseas and bring it in yourself. Yeah. But one of the things I've been particularly interested in the last year or so, because I've been teaching public and contextual theology and I use film in teaching in that, I really wanted to gather film resources and TV resources from the context of Aotearoa New Zealand and the wider Pacific, and particularly as Pacific cinema and stuff like that is developing. And I discovered that all these things which are sort of foundational to New Zealand cinema and things like this are sort of becoming completely unavailable. Yes, some libraries or university libraries might have copies. Yes, the New Zealand Film Archive might have a copy. But actually, to go out there and try and find it yourself as a sort of a private citizen, it's increasingly hard to do that. So I've been sort of scrounging around the place looking for things. I've got a list of what I consider, you know, really important New Zealand film and television that I would like to have as a resource that I'm using, but also in some ways to preserve it. So, you know, I'm regularly going through secondhand stores, rummaging around, looking for things that aren't there. I'm emailing and contacting production companies. In fact, I contacted one production company and I said, I'm looking for this particular film and I can't find it anywhere. I can't buy it anywhere. It's not being streamed. Do you have a copy? And they said, we've got two DVDs left. We'll send them to you for free. So I got the last two DVDs in the country of this film. You know, so I'm trying to build up my own sort of, I guess, New Zealand archive and library. I'm not, and the physical media thing is interesting too, because, you know, your laptops don't have optical drives anymore, or the, you know, so I'm also accumulating kit, you know, so DVD players that can play any region, making sure I've got a Blu-ray player, making sure I've got a VHS player. Making sure I've got the appropriate, you know, even some of the older televisions and things like that. So all these things to try and preserve and continue to engage with material that's sort of disappearing from public memory.
Because I used to find that going, you know, one of the great, the exciting things I would do on a weekend, for example, would be go to the nearest city, because I used to live in rural West Wales. So I'd go to the city, and it would be a treat during the holidays as well, sometimes to go to, maybe in some cases, London, and get physical copies of films that were not available. This was in the days of VHS. And then I succumbed to the DVD and then the Blu-ray revolution. And of course, over recently, as people have said, oh, but you can just stream it on Netflix. And I always resisted that. And I think even now, although I'm aware that, you know, it's probably not sensible to buy lots of more versions of films on Blu-ray because the technology is going to be superseded, I do feel that now more than ever, I have this urge to watch films, to travel, to see something that, you know, Netflix will show something at the, you can watch it on Netflix at home, or you can see it at some of our local cinemas. That Rebecca, obviously the Daphne du Maurier adaptation that's just been made. And I thought, well, I want to see it at the cinema. I want to travel to it, because there's something about, even if I can't get a physical product in the way that I would in the past of going to a record or video store, there is something so important about making that journey, that pilgrimage almost, rather than just saying, oh, I'll just sit at home, get a bottle of beer from the fridge, and I'll just press a few buttons on the remote control. It seems too easy. I don't want a film to be easy. It's not just about the content of the film. It has to be also about the journey. It has to be about the rituals surrounding that. And that gives it a certain excitement, that rather than just randomly think, I'll watch this for 10 minutes, and if I'm bored, I'll move on to something else. As I've made that long trek down to the cinema, you know, I'm stuck with it. And whatever happens, I'm going to let it wash over me for the next 2 hours. But it sounds like you're in a different kind of way. You're involved in a very similar kind of enterprise.
Yeah. I mean, I have, you know, at hand somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 DVDs. And there's particular sort of, you know, things I'm interested in. But I could probably pick any one of those DVDs up and tell you where it came from or how I acquired it. And, you know, part of that has also been the effectively picking at the carcasses of video hire shops as they've gone out of business. And they'll have basically how much can you carry out the store, you know, and they're just selling them by weight almost. You know, you can buy 3 kilos of DVDs and we'll charge you this for it. So in some ways, that's quite a sad experience. You know, those shops where, you know, people would go down and they would sort of sit around and they would sort of try and decide what they're going to watch tonight. That whole sort of social dynamic of, you know, say you are running a youth group and you sent 3 kids down to the video shop to find the video that the youth group was going to watch, and they come back 3 hours later unable to have decided what to done, but they've had quite a good time trying to decide what to watch. Yeah. That's sort of now gone. Everyone just, you're right, sit on the couch and you select from that, and you end up that sort of endless scrolling through things, because what in some ways you get a curated collection that you're given, but it's very hard to actually curate your own sort of subset of that within the parameters that you're given. And I think the DVD or the VHS or something like that allowed you to, you know, go down and look at the shelves or something and say, I'm feeling like, you know, something to do with a noir or something, and I'll pick 3 things from the noir I haven't watched before, or maybe one I have, and then I'll go down and watch that, you know, as opposed to that. Of course, you know, that was quite an expensive way to do it as well. You know, so you're again, it's transient, it's ephemeral. You watch it, you return it. And if you want to watch it again, you pay for it again, as opposed to the streaming. You've paid once for, say, a month, and you can watch it as many times as you want during that month or something like that. So different experience.
Yeah, and I wonder if, whereas in the past I would have a physical copy of something, now because it's something that I'm consuming at the cinema, or it might now be streamed, the equivalent hard copy tends to be the review. And that's something that I didn't used to do in the past. So it's almost as though there has to be something physical. Obviously, I might write it in digital form, but then I'm disseminating it in some way. So that it's as though I need to have something, a concretization of the cinema going experience, which replicates the many. I mean, what you see on the shelf behind me are many books that I've accumulated over the years. But in a different part of my office, I have a whole set of old VHS tapes, which I'm never going to watch, because if anything, they need to be digitized. And, you know, to go to a 4:3 ratio pan and scan format when you're used to everything in super high quality definition is not something, it would feel a backward step. But as you say, it's, I can look at it and say, I bought that in Swansea in 1995, or I bought that I went all the way to London to find that in 1998, that kind of thing. And for that reason, it's part of my heritage, and I guess that's how my nostalgia interest was born.
And the same with, you know, the physical media. Yes, you've got the disc, but you've got the packaging too, and the packaging tells a story of a particular time. The way that you know, film posters change over time, and how a film poster is put together. I just bought a book actually, which is a history of science fiction film posters, and it's really intriguing looking at how they've changed over time, and how different nuances and influences of the culture of the day shape what actually goes on the poster. And so forth. But the same with books, there are some books which I access in digital form. And to be perfectly honest, the postage of getting them to New Zealand is often more than the cost of the book itself. So, physical books from overseas and books here are generally expensive. So, but I find that for digital books, I'll read novels that I'll read quickly and just skim through. And I'll also read, I might buy some academic texts that just are too expensive paper-wise. But what I do miss is opening a book and looking at the typeface and immediately being able to identify the publisher and sort of what period it was probably written in, an IVP or something like this, they use this particular font in the 90s and and there's a particular smell to a book maybe as well, or something like that. And it's also the same with the comic books and graphic novels. Yes, you can, on an iPad is actually something like that is really good for reading comics. And the digital comic services and stuff like that are excellent. But at the same time, when I walk into my local comic store, Heroes for Sale down the road, and Stu and Sue say, "Oh, hi, Stephen. We thought you might be interested in this as well. So we just put it to a side because we know that you are currently watching or currently on order have the Blade Runner 2049 series that's running," or something like this. And that personal contact with a vendor who actually gets to know you and you get to know them, the serendipitous discovery in the store of something you never knew existed before because you happen to be there. And if you're in a digital environment, it's shaping you a certain way and you don't necessarily have that serendipitous encounter. I often think about that with students. Everyone talks about ebooks and stuff like that, and they're really good for students, but you also don't have that serendipitous encounter when you're looking for a book that there are three others nearby that are actually helpful for what you're doing that you would never have known about if you'd come through a different channel to there.
Yeah, I think it's that need not to embark on random experiences, the sense that you plan in advance what you're doing, and that there may be chance encounters and there's the capacity for the unexpected, but you in advance say, right, this is the way my Tuesday's going to go, this is my Thursday, and then everything else slots into place. And then, as you say, within that you don't know necessarily what you're going to be watching, but you sort of know at what time you need to leave. You sort of plan everything around that, and it becomes a very sort of holistic experience which actually involves other people along the way, because you have the people who are shepherding you, you have the conduits, you have the people who serve you the popcorn, or the people who check your ticket, and they'll say, and they'll ask you how the film was, and you'll have a wider conversation about why they work in the cinema, what their passion is, and you divulge a bit about yourself. And so in that sense, it's something that doesn't just feel like something that you want that ends, when you it's not something that you do in a very solitary way. And if you share reviews as I do as well, then it's sort of it's maybe a solitary experience of watching, but then the social part is what you share and disseminate with other people subsequently. So it kind of feels that this has legs, that this can go on for years or decades.
So I'm neither totally pro digital or totally pro analog. I think both have their own unique sort of place, and sometimes I'll have digital copies and physical copies of the same thing. We have at home, we have 1500 novels in our on bookshelves in our hallway. And people come to our place, and while they're there, they say, "Oh, can we borrow a book?" It's really hard to do that with a digital copy. It's really hard to say, we're going to lend you, this particular novel. And then, of course, different people in our household have accumulated different sort of genres, novels and stuff as well. So there are collections within collections. There's something also quite, I think, people walk into the hall, and if they're not book people, they go, "Oh, that's a lot of books." And then they're sort of intrigued. Well, how could someone read that many books or something like that? Yet they'll probably be consuming through their devices quite a lot of reading of blog posts, of social media, maybe of news sites. They'll be doing quite a lot of reading themselves, but they're not thinking that they're reading in the same way as picking up a book. But it's different sort of modes of doing it. So I'm a fan of all of them. I just want people to do it well.
Yeah. And how did the journey start for you then, Stephen? So in terms of childhood, what sort of passions and interests, what sort of memories do you have from growing up? And I'm assuming that you grew up in New Zealand.
Well, I was born in Rotherham in the UK.
I didn't know that.
And So my mother's family are from that part of England, and my father's family are from Surrey. And my mother and father met in London when my mother went down to London to work. Yeah, and so I was born in that part of the world, but for the first 5 years of my life, mostly grew up in Alf Church near Birmingham, where my father was working in Birmingham. And then about 1972, a colleague of my father, good friends of my parents who lived nearby, moved to New Zealand, and they said, "Why don't you come to New Zealand?" And my parents looked around the place. They were saying, "Look, the world looks pretty scary." My uncle was in the London police force, and there were bombings and all sorts of other things going on and tensions, and the world didn't look great. And they're thinking they've got, you know, a young family. Maybe moving to New Zealand would be a good thing to do. So they moved to New Zealand to try it out for a couple of years. So my earliest memories are before coming to New Zealand. I remember going to Portugal as a three-year-old. And even now, the odd smell of the sea will bring back memories from the seaside or stuff that we were doing there. Memories of starting primary school in England, and then coming to New Zealand. And the journey itself was marked by a number of things. I remember getting a whole set of vaccinations I needed to have before I traveled. And as a five-year-old, you know, getting smallpox and cholera and a whole lot of other things is all quite, you know, sort of is scary, because one, they hurt, and two, where are we going? And then the journey in those days too, you know, the airlines took, you know, sort of a circuitous route around the Middle East. So I remember we stopped in Frankfurt. I remember we stopped in Calcutta. We stopped in Hong Kong. We ended up getting stuck in Sydney for a number of days when there was an air traffic controller strike or something like that. And then we eventually arrived in New Zealand in Christchurch. And the business my father had transferred out with had put us out in a motel out in the country, where my mother just nearly sort of freaked out about, you know, it was 2 miles to the nearest place to buy milk. It was a motel which, you know, mostly traveling salespeople would stop at on their way in and out of town. But there were two of us, two families who'd come out with the same company there. And you know, it was a completely different environment. It was countryside in a different way. Everything was sort of the same, but sort of not quite the same. So yes, you could buy Cadbury chocolate, but it tasted a bit different. And certainly I know as children, we probably absorbed the culture shock better than our parents. And certainly my dad working, probably he got into it too. But it took a long time, I think, for my mother to come to grips with it as well. We lived for a couple of years in Christchurch. Then my father transferred to Wellington for work, and we moved there. And that's where I did most of my primary school and high school time there as well.
Have you ever been back to those places, including in the UK as well? Because I always find memories can be very composite, and maybe that's another reason why I keep a diary, so I've got a clear sense of this happened on a particular day, rather than the whole sort of, but it could have happened at any point between 1970 something and 1980 something.
No, particularly my grandparents would come out every year, my father's mother or my mother's parents would come sort of alternating years along with my father's brother and his wife, and we would go back as a family to the UK, fairly regularly. So, you know, every 2 or 3 years. So, you know, we still, you know, maintain some connection with our cousins and uncles and aunts. And also then we visited those places that were family places, I guess, and would reinforce it. So, you know, Wellington and Carshalton in Surrey, and where my father's family all lived, the Rotherham, and then also other places around sort of the north of England as well with others. And so certainly, even when I came back and when I've come back for conferences to the UK, I've often made sort of mini pilgrimages to places. And somewhat, you know, not ironically, but my sister moved back to the UK, well, a long time ago now, but she ended up living, you know, like 2 miles from my uncle and my aunt, and then also a couple of miles from a really good friend of mine who lives in Sutton. So, you know, it's it's when I return to the UK, I'm still going to the same places and having the same memories reinforced along the way. And you know, and I've, you know, that's important to me to revisit those places and to keep touch with those people.
And is it in your childhood or from your childhood that a lot of the interests and passions that you have now around media, for example, and religion were born? In other words, were you doing what I was doing of, you know, collecting records? I wasn't a film person until later on, but do the seeds of all of those passions go back to the childhood?
To a certain extent. I mean, one of my earliest memories when you sort of asked me about that is I remember when I started primary school, I was the only kid in my class who had a library card, and I would have special dispensation to go to the library and to borrow books during school time. And I remember getting the librarian getting a book on dinosaurs down from the top shelf that I couldn't reach. And they were quite concerned that the words were going to be too complicated for me, but I assured them, no, that was fine, and got the book out. So, you know, certainly that sort of a love of reading, I'm incredibly curious. So books provided that way of exploring that curiosity, certain sorts of stories and nonfiction, certainly stuff that was very visual. So nonfiction books that were organized graphically or visually really engaged. I love maps and things like that. In terms of genres of fiction, you know, certainly science fiction, even from a very early age, and particularly anthologies. And school librarians who curate anthologies of different sorts of genre, I think are worth their weight in gold, because they expose you to a whole lot of authors early on in those sort of anthologies that you can say, I really like that story by Andre Norton, or I really like that story by Arthur C. Clarke, or something like that. And then you can springboard into those authors in different ways. The other thing too is, you know, that visual thing comes through for me very much in the area of comics and graphic novels. And so, you know, some of my earliest memories of being in New Zealand actually are some of the comics that I acquired probably when I was, you know, six or so. You know, I've got a Legion of Superheroes, a couple of issues of that. And even now, you know, I've gone back and revisited them, and I can tell you which ones it was that I had then. And then even growing up, you know, my father had he'd grown up on sort of the Flash Gordons and the Buck Rogers and the Eagle comics and stuff. And that sort of, I don't know, genetically or whatever, sort of passed down to me. So I grew up on, you know, 2000 AD comics and other sorts of things like that. And certainly that sort of British comic alongside the American Marvel and DC comics and stuff as well. So, yeah, I wasn't particularly interested in music per se. You know, it just wasn't really a thing that I was interested in. But television and books were huge. And television, as I was growing up in New Zealand, was this really interesting amalgam of different cultural material sort of smashed together. So we had British television shows that we were watching as kids. You know, I remember the Children of the Stones children's horror television show, or the Moon Stallion, or Doctor Who, or things like that. But that smashed up against American TV sitcoms like Charles in Charge or stuff like that, and then Australian and New Zealand productions alongside that. So you had this real sort of exposure to, I suppose, you know, globalization before it was talked about maybe as globalization, because the local producers of content or things like that were curating things. Some of my earliest memories of television are watching things like old black and white Lone Ranger and Dusty's Trail and the Cisco Kid. And a whole lot of Hanna-Barbera cartoons and things like that. So TV and books and comics were certainly part of it. Films and music less so as well.
But do you find that you use a lot of those resources, like the comic books, for your research these days? It sounds as though going back in some ways can be quite cathartic, but I sometimes find that there needs to be a little bit of distance, maybe a critical distance, between something that is your fandom, something that you associate with childhood, something that is very precious. And then, of course, when your academic career moves in a very different direction to what you could ever have anticipated one doing with one's life in childhood, then sometimes you need to sort of take a deep breath. But there's always a point, I find, when I can say, I'm ready to do this now. But have you had any similar kind of experiences?
Well, I mean, I think I probably did, because in terms of my own academic career, I didn't really come to popular culture as an academic discipline until probably about 15 years or so ago. Prior to that, in my, I'd been doing computer science at university. I had then, gone on to do postgrad. I'd worked in industry. I'd gone back to do some computer science research, and then somehow had fallen into doing theology, and then did my BD and PhD, and then sort of out of that ended up where I was at a university. I was teaching a course called The Bible in Popular Culture. I had, between 350 and 400 students in a lecture theatre twice a week, and when I passed the microphone round to say, why are you here? So the first time I passed it round, the first person said, I'm here because I'm so glad the gospel's going to be preached in this godless satanic university. And it was just this collective gasp. And they passed the microphone to the next person who said, I'm a Christian too, but not the same sort as that other person. And then I passed it to the next person who said, I'm a media studies person. I'm really interested in the media studies side of it. And then I passed it to someone else and they said, oh, my friend said I should come to this because we just watch television in this course and we don't actually do any work. So so I was there and I was, what we're trying to do in that course is, how has biblical material been represented in popular culture? How has it been interpreted, transformed, portrayed, and for what sort of reasons? And some of those are secular and some of those are religious, some of those, different sort of biases, but also then how has that interpretation of those things in popular culture then come back to reshape religion and perceptions of religion as well? So yes, the class were having to read, huge chunks of the Gospels in the New Testament, having to read Old Testament prophets, because we want to talk about how prophecy is portrayed in popular culture. But we're also talking about how does that portrayal by Charlton Heston of Moses really then reshape how people thought about the biblical text or the message or things like that as well. What about the different portrayals of Jesus in different ways? How does that and does it offend you or not offend you? I actually had a disclaimer in the first lecture of any course like that to say, I'm going to offend everybody in this class by the end of it. It's not intentional. So I have Muslim students in the front row and I'm going to be showing images of prophets. Because we're going to look at Moses films and Jesus films and things like that. So, there's not an intention to offend, but, in doing that, there's a sense of how do you handle both the text of popular culture and the sacred text well and bring them into a dialogue, which then is help explain some of the world we see around us in different ways. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in doing that, then some of the essays that students wrote started to say, oh, there's a research project in that or something like that. So then I sort of started to, I'd already started to think about the religious portrayals in different ways and particularly in comics and graphic novels and television shows and things like that. But to actually move beyond that, to actually say, what's the world going on behind the text, in the text, before the text? How are these sort of things going on? And out of it, discovering whole areas of popular culture I never knew existed. So, currently Netflix is running their Warrior Nun television show, but there's a whole legacy of Warrior Nun comic books that stretches back decades. And some of it has some quite deep theology going on in it, as well as also nuns as superheroes. In fact, when I did a paper on this and presented it to some of my colleagues who were Catholic sisters, they said, well, obviously we are superheroes, they wouldn't admit to keeping katana swords under their beds or anything like that. But, it's quite an interesting sort of thing to be. But you're right, the distancing, the fanboy, fangirl thing is important. This is one of the things with the students. Often they couldn't separate the two when they came to write about their beloved topic to think critically. So there's always that element there of stepping back from it a little bit, but also that sense of, I am passionate about this. I do enjoy this particular sort of thing, but actually, what is the purpose for which I am watching something? Sometimes it's to enjoy it. Other times it's maybe like you're reviewing a film. You're going in there because you actually want to think deeply about it and make some commentary on it as well.
No, and I think that's very important because it's almost as though you need the groundwork, you need the scaffolding, you need the methodology, the contours, in order to frame the debate. So you know what you're doing, say, with a film, because it's very awkward. You must have had this as well, when you have a student who is asked to write a 2,000-word theological review or something of a film. And then what they really do is tell you why so-and-so is their favorite movie. And you don't, and you feel awful giving them a not very good mark because you say there's nothing wrong with your choice of film and your passion comes through, but that wasn't the exercise. And that's the thing that I sometimes struggle with, that sometimes somebody can be, and it can happen from the other angle as well with faith. I mean, occasionally we'll have students taking a wild module. So I obviously teach in religious studies. But there might be a student who wants to do something in, I don't know, religion and film, but they're coming at it from a faith angle rather than because they're doing religious studies. And then they don't have the same disciplinary background. And then they get a bit confused sometimes along the way because they're not quite sure what the point is of the module because they think it's to reinforce or to supplement their faith. And yet the other students are doing this as a critical academic study. So sometimes you have, all these various elephants in the room. You have all these different constituencies of thought, and you have to bring them all together. And occasionally it does work because you sort of say to the students, this is the purpose of the module, this is what we're doing. And you're right, you might be offending sensibilities along the way, but you're doing it in a very empathetic and sensible and also learned way where you're saying there are antecedents to this. There are academic contours. So you're not sort of doing it to wind somebody up. You're doing it because it's the curriculum. And I think once the students are with you, then they're very happy. And their essay sometimes can reflect that because I've had students who've felt a real tension between their personal beliefs and their academic study, and they've managed to channel that through their academic writing.
And it's lovely when you see that. Sometimes too, anybody coming to anything, one of the things, say we're coming to say Jesus films, what I'll ask them to do is just on two axes, here's an axis between, what's, how positive or negative do you feel towards the figure of Jesus? Just put an X where you think that is. And so for someone who's coming from a very strong faith perspective, they have quite a, quite an interesting response to that, as opposed to someone who may have absolutely no idea who Jesus is in class, or never only had sort of cultural afterlights. And then I will ask them to say, now on the vertical axis, why don't you plot how well you respond, or how you respond to visual media? So when you're coming to this Jesus film, here's two things to think about. How do you understand your own relationship and whatever you want to think about that with the figure of Jesus Christ? And then how do you actually respond to a medium like film? Because, some people just, it doesn't matter what you do in film, it's just not their thing, or that particular sort of style. And that's always a helpful starting point for them thinking about, oh, I think I'm here. And so, maybe when I come to this, I'm expecting this and this and this from it. And also I might not actually enjoy this, even though I, because I actually just don't get this particular genre and or medium and how it works as well. And so that's quite a interesting. I found satire is one of those things too, also that is really hit or miss with a class. It can work one year, it cannot work the next year. There was a television series in New Zealand, animated show called Brotown in New Zealand, and effectively it's a story of four Samoan teenagers and a Māori teenager, five boys. And every episode, every week, is a morality play about their experience living in multicultural sort of Auckland, and particularly their Maori and Pacific communities. But it's bookended by the introduction to the morality play and the end of it set in heaven. And in heaven, the figure of God the Father is a Pacific patriarch wearing his lava lava with his Pacific tattoos. Jesus is an angsty teenager who's sort of in teenage rebellion sometimes, stuff like this. But out of that, they frame a problem or a particular issue, which then these young boys, and it's satire, and it's, so it's comedy, but with a quite a pointed point to it about something to do with New Zealand society or something like that. And then it cuts back to heaven at the end for the wrap up. Now, when I use that sort of film clip in class, different students react quite differently to it. Some students will actually laugh along with it, others will be quite offended. You know, and because they you know, the notion of satire is sometimes, you know, what's the point that's been got at? Stop being offended quite so much, but the offense is also part of the point of satire. You know, that's what it's trying to draw in to alert you to something. And so that can be quite an interesting one. I mean, I've shown films of Jesus films where Jesus is laughing with his disciples, and students have come to see me afterwards and said they couldn't identify at all with it because Jesus was serious all the time and he didn't tell jokes. And I said, have you read the Gospels? And they say, what do you mean? I said, there's a whole lot of stuff in there that you should be reading and hearing people laughing as they get it. And then others who come to say, oh, that's a Jesus who laughs. Jesus doesn't laugh in our church. You know, I quite like the Jesus who might be my friend or engage with me in that sort of banter. You know, I haven't thought of Jesus about that before. Now, the actual what happens in the film is a whole lot of extra biblical stuff that's written into the script and stuff. So then getting to think about the production of it, you know, what is the artistic dimension? What's the literary sources being drawn on? What's the theology? What's the history that's here? How do they all fit together? Does it create a narrative around Jesus that you find satisfying in more than one dimension and stuff like that? So, I mean, that's, you know, that's the sort of thing that that does come up. And so I tend to, you know, one, I obviously taught deliberately on this, but also if I'm teaching ethics or if I'm teaching Christian spirituality or if I'm teaching contextual theology, I'll be looking for a variety of media that might engage students' sensibilities in different ways from the standard text. And so I've done this in two ways in class before. So one is the design your own film festival. So this is for public theology. Have the, you know, how do you articulate something in the public square that's intelligible and credible? And so they pick a particular issue that they want to explore or something to communicate. And then they curate a selection of films. They create film posters. They write an a theological sort of informed exegesis around their films and what they're trying to achieve and how they put it together. And then a number of students, once they've done the assignment, have gone on to actually do it. And you know, so someone might pick, you know, HIV. And so they might pick a whole lot of films from the 80s that were starting to come out to wrestle that. Someone else picked the notion of cultural identity in New Zealand. And so they pick some films that have come out of Maori and Pacific and Asian communities and have curated them together in different ways. The other side of it too is when I teach digital media, theology and media, is this idea of, you know, well, we talk about how these things interact, but let's actually get you to do it. You know, pick a particular theme like home or work or employment or nature, and then go out there with your smartphone and take as many photos as you can, and then curate me an installation of your photos explaining how they link together, the story that goes with them, your theological reflection on that theme of home, and you bring them together so that the, you know, they're using the media rather than just actually and engaging with it and experiencing it. And one of the things that they've said, and this pops up in other people who've written on photography and spiritual formation and things, that the moment you start taking photos intentionally, they notice things in their community that they hadn't noticed before because they're looking for a photo, because they're taking lots of photos. They hadn't noticed that part of the community before. They hadn't noticed those people who did there. They hadn't, you know, they're thinking about how they would compose a photo. So what things are important in the photo? And so suddenly it changes their whole theological lens almost in some ways of how they think about the community around them by actually using this medium.
And do you find that your teaching evolves in the sense that do you pick up on some of the different strands some of the students work from one year and think, oh, that really worked? Or to an extent, maybe the students are teaching you in the sense that you learn something from them that you then want to incorporate into the teaching in its next iteration.
Absolutely. I mean, also, I, you know, with their permission, keep copies of their work and stuff like that. But, you know, when I was talking at AAR the end of last year on digital theology and how you would go about it, one of the points I was making is that voices need to be part of this conversation around digital theology who aren't North American, UK, Australian and New Zealand white people, for want of a better word, Where are the voices on the margins? Where are the others? And then I give them some, and then I use some examples with permission from some of my Maori students and Pacific students on some of the photos they've taken and the narration they've added to them, which provides a completely different perspective, but one which sits alongside the other perspectives as well. And so trying to not only learned, I mean, I don't speak for my students. I learn from them, and I often say this is what I have learned from them in doing this, and want to showcase their work, but I really want to promote their voices into that conversation too, so that the conversation is far more diverse than it is at the moment.
And how did you end up working in academia? As you mentioned, computer science is how it all started, but how did you end up doing what you're doing now?
Oh my goodness. So originally I went to university, when I was 18. My mother drove me to the airport, put me on a plane. I flew to Christchurch and I was at the University of Canterbury there. And I went originally to study astronomy and chemistry. I'm a systems person. So I'd done geography and biology and chemistry and things like that. I love how systems fit together. So, but astronomy was a love of mine as well, as an amateur sort of astronomer. And Canterbury was, at that point, was the place to go if you wanted to do some astronomy. So I signed up for a science degree. I did first year astrophysics and classical astronomy and maths and chemistry and some computer science. And at the end of my that first year, I thought, oh, I quite like this computer science stuff. I'd always had a technological bent and we had a home computer and stuff like that. Maybe I'll do that. So I applied for entry into the program. It was limited entry at that point and got into computer science. So then I sort of completed my undergraduate degree there, went on and then did a master's degree in computer science as well. And then, went back to work in industry for a while because I was getting married. My wife to be was working in Wellington at that time. She'd come through, we'd met at the university together. She'd come through operations research, which is closely related to computer science and stuff like that. And so we had sort of mutual friends in common through that. And then in Wellington working for, the big telecommunications company, and then deciding really that I wanted to try my teeth at a PhD in computer science. So I went off to a different university to do that, where a friend of mine from Canterbury was there doing his PhD and joined a machine learning team there to build inductive learning systems that you gave real world data to, and it produced a model of the real world that you could then use in various ways. To be honest, pretty much out of my depth for a lot of that. But what I really did enjoy was the application of the technology to real world problems. So I actually stayed on as a researcher for a while. I didn't finish the PhD. I became far more interested in the stories people told about technology and the language they were using. And why were they using God language to describe what they were doing, even if they weren't religious, creating these worlds and universes and things like that. But then I was at, I was then working back in the IT industry, particularly in internet and manufacturing systems and things like that. And I was an elder at our church, and we had a church who was, which was really pro people asking questions. There was no question off the table. We actually ran a house group, a small group with a group of us who were sort of in that sort of 20-year-old age range, no kids at that point. And, that's where, think questions around politics, around faith and life in the real world were thrashed out and, from a whole range of different sort of perspectives. Actually, out of that group, I think three of us have gone on to finish PhDs in theology, and one's also done a master's in theology and is working on a PhD on something else related to that. So, out of that small group of people, there was very much, we were encouraged to think critically about our faith. And so I then went to where I'm currently working now for a one-year graduate diploma so that I could come back to the church and do some teaching in various sorts of ways. My wife said after about 6 weeks, it was clear it wasn't 10 months we'd come to Auckland for. And so I ended up finishing the BD and then the PhD. And the PhD itself was drawing together the computer science and the theology. So I was particularly interested in the stories of technological salvation, people were saying, you know, how technology was going to save us, how, you know, questions around the language around things like, you know, the singularity, and we can seize control of our own evolution now through technology and become like God. So, you know, my PhD work looked at the doctrine of the image of God, how that related to Christian understandings of doing technology and technological sort of proclivity, brought that into dialogue with the whole sort of transhumanism, posthumanism stuff, and then also a lens of Christian social justice and concern to filter all that out. And at the end of it, I had a PhD. There were no jobs going anywhere. Along the way, I'd done a bit of adjunct lecturing around the place and things like that, but there was nothing there. So fortuitously, I ended up working for a Roman Catholic college for about 6 months part-time, helping put together one of their first online programs. So it was technological. I wasn't adding any theology to them. I'm Presbyterian. They wouldn't let me in front of their students, I don't think. But you know, then at the end of that year, which was a pretty hard year all up, having done all this training and nowhere to go, a job came up at the University of Auckland for a practical theologian who would also look after their undergraduate program. And I happened to be in the right place at the right time, and you know, got into it that way. And before I know it, you know, I was teaching a whole lot of stuff I'd never even thought about teaching before. Contextual theology, various sorts of practical theology. I mean, I'd come out of systematics mostly. And so suddenly there I was, you know, doing it. But I've always, you know, thought carefully. I mean, I have a love of teaching. And so I'm always thinking about the craft of teaching, the art of teaching. How can I, you know, and the students themselves were, I mean, I've taught in both, you know, faith-based colleges and secular universities, and each has their own distinct flavor and joys that they bring. The university environment was such that, you know, I never knew who I was going to have in my class. I have a mixture of Anglican ordinands, you know, Sikh students. I'd have those of no faith, but who were interested in how religion engaged with the public square. And, you know, here I am as the Christian theologian teaching theology in that secular environment, but in a way in which engaged those students in different ways, and how those different students, you know, rubbed off on each other and raised questions the others wouldn't have thought about. Then when also teaching in sort of the faith-based context, then there's far more of the sense of how does the faith that you have actually shape faith and life? And the application side of it, you know, if you believe this, then what does that actually mean for when you get out of bed in the morning and what you're going to do for today? Both of them have their joys. Both environments at times have their own sort of stresses in different ways as well. But I mean, I love both of them. Academia is my tribe, if you want to say that. I mean, I can't, my happy place is, you know, whether it's an international conference hanging with colleagues I see every 2 years, or whether it's, you know, talking with a student pastorally about, you know, their research project or the essay or, you know, just their life along the way.
Yeah, there is a sense of coming full circle, because so many people I've interviewed as well have done degrees in other subjects and have ended up doing something, maybe at PhD level, that's when they did something very interdisciplinary, and then they ended up as a specialist in a very different discipline to what their undergraduate degree was all about. So it kind of feels, listening to what you were saying, that this has worked out so perfectly, but you could never have anticipated when you were studying the sciences that you would have gone down this path. But yet it seems to be wonderfully integrative and idiosyncratic. You know, nobody else could have done exactly what you're doing and in the way that you've cultivated it.
I think one of the things I love about the academic life is that interdisciplinary nature. So one of the things I did while I was working at the University of Auckland was I did a postgraduate certificate in academic practice, and there was a cohort of about a dozen of us from different faculties, each meeting every 2 weeks to discuss what it meant to be an academic in a university. Everything from what's the purpose of a university through to teaching, learning and assessment, through to our research projects, through to going to other people's, and I went to the architecture, my friend Dermot, who was in the architecture school, to observe his lecture. He came to my public theology lecture. I went to, you know, to see someone else who was teaching materials science in a in an incredibly imaginative way, whose career has now gone on to, you know, become a science educator and stuff like that. All these sorts of things, you know, these conversations you have. I mean, that sense of being able to learn from all sorts of different people, regardless of their faith background, regardless of their discipline. But actually, I just find what everybody does really interesting. And so in some ways, being a practical theologian, where I bring the resources of the faith, so scripture and tradition and other things like that, into dialogue with the real world and the issues that are happening there, means that I never get bored, because I'm not, you know, only an expert on this particular doctrine, or I'm not an expert on this particular chemical reaction. What I am thinking about is, I describe myself more as an integrative theologian. How can I integrate this amazing work that's going on in other disciplines with my own discipline in a way that actually makes a difference to people and they understand it? I do publish, you know, academic articles and journals and books and all that sort of stuff, but I get a real kick out of something I've written for a more popular audience that then someone at a youth ministry conference comes up to me and says, I read your article and it changed my life, and about how I thought about media and what I did with young people or something like that.
And so, do you have that with your students as well? Do you find that students from yesteryear come up to you? Are you still in touch with many of the students from your past?
Yeah, to a certain extent, because, you know, a lot of them now are moving into, certainly the theology students, into positions of leadership around the country and stuff like that. And I get a real buzz out of seeing that and seeing what they're doing. And you know, I keep track with many of them through social media and stuff like that. Similarly, the friends I made at university, I mean, I haven't really kept touch with anyone from school days. In fact, for me, the transition from high school to university was almost a renaissance, a rebirth of myself and a reinvention of myself. But the friends that I made then, both my wife and I have really strong and wide networks, and we keep in touch with everybody over the last sort of 30 years. So much so we pretty much know what's going on around the place. And even those people when I was doing, you know, postgrad computer science at Canterbury, you know, a lot of those I'm on Facebook with and still in touch with and still really interested in what they're doing, and they're interested in what I'm doing, you know, and yeah, you know, those sort of things and those sort of conversations do continue. But I do keep track of my students and what they're doing, and sometimes they surprise me and they, you won't remember me, but I was in your class of 350 and you said this, and I'd never read the gospel like that before, or I'd never thought that, you know, film could be used that way, or that popular culture was actually shaping my imagination about God in a certain way that may not have been as healthy as I thought it was, or I hadn't realized that I was reacting in a certain way because of, you know, cultural afterlives of biblical stories or popular cultural things. So yeah, it's really, I mean, I get a real buzz out of that, just the same as I get a buzz out of, you know, supervising an incredibly diverse set of postgraduate students for their masters and PhDs. As well. And I mean, I've learned so much from my graduate students along the way, you know, whether it's about Samoan theology or what's happened in Burmese culture, or, you know, how you engage with ideas of atonement in Japanese culture, or Maori perspectives on things at the moment, theology and disability. You know, there's some amazing sort of work that's going on by grad students that, you know, I'm just so enriched by being part of that journey with them.
And that comes out very clearly, because just a few more philosophically based questions as we start to wrap up, Stephen. But would you say that your memories as you survey your life and career are predominantly positive ones?
Oh, I thought quite hard about this, you know, sort of just coming into this. I think they're a real mix. You know, there are certain memories. I mean, I didn't really enjoy high school that much, so the memories of that aren't necessarily positive. But they did make me who I am, and there were, you know, I've had to reflect on them in different ways, which have had positive outcomes from that. There's some things too. There are certain experiences when I was doing my sort of first year of postgrad computer science. When looking back now, I realize that my own understanding of my own mental health gives me a real handle on understanding what I was going through at that time. So yes, that was actually, you know, some of it was quite hard, some of it was quite painful, but it's still an experience that shaped who I am. And now I can reflect back and explain it. It helps me narrate to myself going forward to a certain extent. So I think it's a real mixture, but certainly, you know, there are certain markers. You know, the friends I made in my first year at university in the halls of residence and second year are the friends that, you know, we can slip back into conversation as if it was yesterday, even if we haven't seen each other for a couple of years. I have, you know, some very dear friends from that time that we still continue to walk with each other and keep in touch with each other. And then along the way too, the relationships that I've made, you know, when I started doing my PhD, I started blogging in the early 2000s. And out of that, I have this huge, rich network of people I've never met before in my life who are part of my, you know, academics and personal support, you know, group kind of thing. And I support them and they support me. And then occasionally we get to a conference and we'll meet for the first time, you know, after maybe 13 years of emails and blog postings and things like that. And it's like, there's some really bad stuff about social media and the internet, but there's also some really good stuff that comes out of it as well. A real richness. But yeah.
No, it's how you navigate it. I think you're right, because I was wary of social media for years. I think it was just more because I thought, oh, I'm too busy. But of course, you can then use it as, it's a perfect way actually of disseminating the kind of things you're interested in the way that you want to, and then to see what sort of take up there is on that, because there are some things I post that always get more of a reaction than other things. And you've got the banal and you've got the more serious things. And I think the two need to be held together. And if you just do a stream of, you know, erudite film reviews or something, then you're going to lose a lot of your audience because people just haven't got the time or the inclination to follow them. But on the other hand, you might find that something that's a bit more lightweight can actually make people think, you know, you're saying exactly what I'm thinking, that you're chiming with the zeitgeist. So it's a delicate balancing act. But you discovered the way that you interact with people and the way they interact with you in lots of different formats, and I think social media has can have many advantages, but it's the way it's used, and I'm very selective about the way that I put my signature on it.
Yeah, and different media too. So you can write a blog post on a blog, and you know, I've had a blog for however long now, 20 years almost, it feels like. And you know, I don't you know, religiously update it every day. But it's something which, you know, I can actually reflect back on too. I often use it to go back to look at what I was thinking, what I was writing. You know, something that's more carefully curated than the Facebook post, which is ephemeral. And, you know, it's really hard to go back and find something that you wrote or that someone else wrote on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or something like that. But with a blog, you know, you can do that. But again, you know, there's a permanence there to it, which sometimes may or may not be helpful depending on what you've been blogging about at a certain point in your time, you know, particularly if you're, say, going for a job somewhere and someone says, we read on your blog that you did this, whereas, you know, perhaps on social media they might not see that to a certain extent or vice versa.
Yes. So it's knowing the audience and also knowing what your students are potentially watching as well. It's a good way of sometimes just keeping you in check.
Yeah, I mean, I have this, you know, someone asked me the other day, you know, how do you feel? And, you know, do you look forward or do you look back? So in my work at the moment, I'm particularly exploring the notion of Christian hope as a way of linking together different things I'm thinking about theologically about digital culture. So how does Christian hope speak into social media, speak into digital theology and link things together? So on one hand, I'm looking forward, but I also spend a lot of time looking back. And so I'm a bit like, if you've ever read Umberto Eco's book, The Island of the Day Before, where Roberto is on the ship that's on one side of the dateline, you know, medieval sort of times, and he can look out from the ship across the shark-infested waters to the island that's on the other side of the meridian. And in the book, you know, he's thinking that if only I can get back to the island of the day before, I can undo all the decisions that I made badly in my life. But I have to learn to swim because he can't swim. So he's sort of stuck there. And sometimes I feel I'm a little bit like that. On one hand, you know, I do have a looking backness to what if I'd made that decision differently? What if I'd done this differently? Would I have still have ended up at the same place? But at the same time, my own faith commitment is one to the hope that's found that's drawing us forward as well in Christ. And so that actually balances out the two of them. So maybe I'm Janus. Maybe I've got a face looking either way. You know, that's the way.
Well, that, Stephen, is a perfect way to end. Thank you for your time. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's very late in the evening where you are, but thank you for being my guest this week.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Chris.